The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Welcome to The Weekly Connect with me, Stephen Scott, with you this week. This is the programme where you can talk about the issues that matter to you. Whatever those issues are, whether they be the good, the bad, or the ugly of sight loss, this is the place that you can talk about those issues. With me this week, my guests are Alan Russell, host of the Early Edition, and anything that relates to politics on this station, you're the guy.
It would appear so.
You are our Jeremy Paxman of RNIB, aren't you?
I'll accept that. That works for me.
Our guest this week, who wants to talk about a whole wide range of issues, and one in particular that's very pertinent at the moment, is David Aldwinkle, who's head of community engagement at RNIB, and he's a visually impaired guy like us. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Stephen. Hello, Ellen. How are you doing?
Hi there.
Now, you're... Three topics this week cover, well, a wide range of different things, actually, because the first thing you want to talk about is personal independence payment.
Sharp intake of breath.
Yeah, I know. Where do we start on that one? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. The second topic you want to bring up is around barriers that we place on ourselves as blind or partially sighted people that could be holding us back. Is that the right way to put it?
Yeah, I think that's as good a way as any, I think.
And third topic, if we get time, because these are huge topics to discuss, we'll see if we get this all in. But the third topic that you wanted to bring up was around Amazon Echoes, because you've got one. Not just one, actually, you've got a few and you love them.
I have three now, yes, and I love them as much as my kids do.
I thought you were going to say as much as your kids.
Okay, more than my kids.
Of course, yes, yes.
Far more useful.
Well, let's move on quickly, because you never know whose wives are listening in these programs. I've learned that the hard way. Okay, so let's start with personal independence payment, David. Of course, this is a huge area. I'm going to hand it to you to give us your sort of thoughts on this, because you've been going through the process of application, and I know you wanted to share your thoughts on this week.
Yeah, so where this started for me, Stephen, was that I moved house last summer, and as a conscientious recipient of DLA, I told the DWP, which then triggered a change of circumstances on my record, which automatically brought in the, okay, so we're going to withdraw DLA from you and you need to go through the application for PIP. That was fine as far as I was concerned. You know, I knew it was going to come at some point. I'm not particularly worried about doing this sort of thing. I think I can make my case. I think there's an obvious need for why I have been getting this DLA for longer than I can remember, 25 years or so. And so I, if I'm honest, I kind of dived into it. I thought, all right, let's just get it over and done with. So I went through the process. I got the forms, the forms which are inaccessible, but you kind of learn to live with stuff like that, don't you? And went through the process. I spoke to a few friends, a few people online, and just said, hey, you know, any tips? And, you know, people were generally quite helpful, although there was a kind of a general undercurrent of, you know, good luck, you know, hope it goes well. And you know, I know from my experience of, you know, I've worked in welfare rights years ago, I know a lot of people, understand the system, and you know, just generally there's an undercurrent of, you know, this stuff is here to help us, but it kind of gets given grudgingly, and you know, you kind of are made to feel a little bit like you're going with a begging bowl. But I kind of brushed that away. Right, let's just get on with it. So I completed the form. I used I actually used RNIB's guide to completing it, which I found really helpful. And to be really honest, I thought that the form was good. I thought it did its job. It made me give all the information that was relevant to explain to someone who doesn't understand what it's like to live with kind of little or no sight. The things that are hard, not the things that necessarily I can't do, you know, 100% can't do, but the things that are hard, you know, crossing the road, keeping on the pavement, things like that, you know, the basic stuff. So I sent that off. I then got my assessor visit, and my assessor came round, and she was very nice and asked me a number of questions, and certainly came across as if she understood my situation. And she actually said it a few times. And when she did, when she did the vision assessment, they laughingly call a vision assessment, she apologised in advance, said, "I know this is daft. I know that you don't, you know, this is a pointless thing for you." And so we went through the assessment, and actually she, at the end of it, she told me that prior to doing the job she was doing, she worked for a long time at Sense, the Sensory Loss charity. And I was quite heartened by that, I have to say. In previous incarnations, I know that they've pulled in every Tom, Dick and Harry off the street to do these assessments and given them 2 hours multi-disability training and then said, "Yeah, you're an expert, you're a health professional now, off you go." And so I felt quite heartened by the fact that she was doing the assessment, and so obviously had some experience of people who found it difficult to see. So I waited, and then just before Christmas, a couple of weeks before Christmas, I got the letter saying, out of a possible however many points it is, you need to get 8 or 12 on each one to qualify, and on daily living you got 4 points, and on mobility you got 0. So thanks, good night, we're removing all of you. You're not getting your DLA back, the carer's allowance has been stopped, that won't be reintroduced. All the other possible benefits you could have got, if you have a car for motability, we're going to take that away. You're going to get council tax is going to be taken away. All of this, ESA will be affected. Any other benefits you'll get, they will be affected. Oh, by the way, if you think we've got it wrong, tell us. So I looked at it and I phoned them and I said, you've got it wrong. And I looked at their report, which was terribly inaccessible and also just terrible in its quality. And there were statements in there such as, to navigate a familiar route, you use a navigation aid, your long white cane, you use wayfinding apps. When it's over a distance, you use taxis because you can't use a bus. And went through and explained all the things that found it hard and then said, and so therefore you can navigate that familiar route. And I just was, my jaw hit the floor. I couldn't believe that someone could take all of those things, which all those things automatically qualify you for the benefit, and they said, and so therefore you don't qualify. And it was just absolutely flabbergasted. I can't even begin to, I certainly couldn't tell you the words I used stomping around the house afterwards, if we're going to broadcast this at all. I've phoned them. I said, "You've got it wrong. Reassess me, please." I then wrote to them with the help of RNIB's legal rights team, who were excellent, and they pointed out all of the legalities of everything that this decision had got wrong. And I'm really pleased to say, Steve, I don't think I've had a chance to tell you, but earlier this week I got the letter saying, actually, no, you do qualify for everything. We got it 100% wrong.
There's a surprise.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
But the thing that really got me was that, I thought the system was okay. I didn't think it was too bad. I know lots of other people have had a lot worse experience than me. The thing that got me was that the decision was so outrageously wrong that it either suggests that the people who are making those decisions just have no idea and shouldn't be doing the job, or that the kind of suspicion is that they're incentivized in some way, which makes them do the job badly. And I don't know which it is, but it's either way, it's incredibly wrong. And so whilst I was going through this, I just put out a few messages on social media, and I spoke to colleagues in the RNIB. And the colleagues in RNIB were saying, yeah, we're getting this all the time now. Loads of people this is happening to. I put it out onto Facebook and onto one of the Connect groups out there, and I said, just as anyone else had an experience like this. And I got so many people coming back and saying, yeah, that happened to me. I didn't get it until I went through tribunal. And yeah, it's people saying, I've supported my partner, my wife, my husband to go through this. Their decision was entirely wrong. They've had it reversed now. And it just is incredible that so many people are being so badly treated, that I really wanted us to talk about it and to hopefully reach out and sort of say to people who are listening to this, if you're going through this, we're with you, you'll get through it, but let's try and do something about it.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you so much for being so honest about that, because
I think saying everything you've just said will probably relax a lot of people like me at the moment. I'll talk about that in a moment. But Alan, of course, you're listening into this. I mean, you know, you've been through this process as well. What do you think about what David's experienced?
Yeah, it eventually came round to me as well. And like David, I have had DLA, Disability Living Allowance, for some time. And I had the exact same feeling when I heard about PIP and the word reassessment. I immediately thought, tripwires. And here come the complicated forms that are not accessible. There's going to be questions which are going to be very convoluted in certain ways, and you feel a little bit demeaned because you feel, again, as David said, you're out there with the cap in hand saying, yes, can I please have this? I think I'm bad enough to get it. When it should really be, well, you know, I do qualify for this. Why is it so difficult? We've all heard the stories about the not very well qualified people doing assessments. We've seen the horror stories in the papers. I think also when PIP was coming into play, when they were still doing some of the work on constructing it, the fact that at one point it was said that a white cane and a guide dog were not mobility aids, that I...
What are they then?
My jaw dropped, and I thought, right, okay, if I'm out on the street and you take away my guide dog, what do? I can't take a step. So if that's not a mobility aid, then I don't know what is. It's like taking a wheelchair away from someone and setting them on the pavement saying, right, carry on. You can't do it. So, you know, I was really pleased that RNIB were behind this as well. A lot of work being done in the background within Parliament to get a lot of these things changed. And then eventually the call came through. And they said, yeah, we're going to do your reassessment for PIP. I want to ask you some questions. And I felt a bit unprepared at the time. But they weren't too bad. You know, they were very basic. And they said, you know, you're going to get the form out. And I thought, oh, good, another form for someone else to fill out, for me to tell someone else what to put on a form. And I sought help from RNIB and from Deafblind Scotland because I'm always very wary about the forms. I think as David also mentioned earlier on, you know, there's a lot of concern about filling them out, and we've seen the horror stories in the papers about quotas of not passing people through, and I've heard of people being rejected, and straight away, you know, a cane or a guide dog, that's 12 points on your mobility component, that's full points, so it should guarantee you that. And I know people who use these aids have been refused, and you have to think that there's something in this. You don't want to think that, but you do. And you know, you do feel a bit demeaned with someone sitting who doesn't know you telling them, yeah, I can't do this, oh no, I can't do that, and I can't do this either. And yeah, but I did research it quite a bit, and you know, I found out a lot about myself as well. Actually, when I spoke about it, things I never realised that I had problems with that were on the form. You know, to do with things like cooking and health and safety around that. I thought, do you know, I didn't know. You're right, I can't do that, but I never thought of it as a barrier, so I wouldn't have mentioned it in the form. And just to pick up on something which again, David, you mentioned, going out on a familiar route with my guide dog, and they said, okay, so you could follow that route, say just out of your front door down the pathway to the car, you could walk that just along the path a little bit without your dog. And I said, well, yes, as long as the road hadn't been dug up, there wasn't bags left, black bag, bin bags or wheelie bins out, so you know, there is no such thing as a regular route that you could walk independently, because you know, routes change through factors out with your control, and they have to be taken into consideration. And I think also the fact that if you lose PIP, the amount of support that disappears, you know, it's quite frightening. It really takes away a lot from individuals. I was fortunate that I passed through it without any problems. And I got what I was entitled to get. And I think I want to use that word. You know, we are entitled to get this. We're not saying, oh, I'm blind, can I have this, please? And I, you know, I hate the word welfare and benefit. I don't think it is. I think it's just something that helps us. So I still worry that the system isn't quite right. And I hear these horror stories all the time. You know, I can breathe a sigh of relief. I've been through it. But I still have these concerns. And I also think about the cost. How much does it cost to do all these reassessments? How much does it cost the taxpayer to have all these people reassessed when it's blatantly obvious they shouldn't have been refused in the first place? There's a huge financial impact there. And I think as taxpayers, we should be really worried worried about that. Never mind the people or their families and so on who are on these things like personal independence payments. The taxpayer should be really worried about this as well.
Absolutely. And it worries me, Alan, as well, that, you know, I get refused and I know, well, you know, I'm going to stand up and make sure I damn well get this stuff. But there, if I think back the first time I applied for DLA, I was turned down, you know, 25 years ago. And my immediate reaction was, oh, I just don't qualify, then I won't have it.
Yeah, that's it. And you wonder if that's designed to put people off in the first place. You know, if you really need it, then you're going to reapply and you're going to appeal. And that's so, so wrong.
There's so many people will just walk away and say, particularly as it's the thing of not wanting to kind of demean yourself, not want to make yourself feel as vulnerable as you can do when you're doing this stuff. And you want to give it, you know, you, for your own kind of pride and your self-esteem, we all get on with our lives, you know, and so you want, you, if someone says, well, you're not, you don't qualify now, you must be all right, you kind of go, well, okay then, you know.
Yeah, and also I think we have to remember, you know, when we talk about personal independence payment, it's to give someone who, if we're taking someone who's blind as an example, yeah, their independence. So you're helping with the use of that money for someone to perhaps pay for someone to help clean the home. You're paying to get you out and about, to end the isolation, to go, make it easier to travel to job interviews, to doctor's appointments, and the social side of it as well, for mental health, to go and meet people, to get out, to take part in leisure activities. It opens so many doors, and it's not just about someone having money in their bank. It's the advantages and the opportunities that having that money creates.
Absolutely right.
You know, I'm currently going through the process, and it's such a joy. Let's be fair, it's just a lovely experience. And I did the thing that I probably shouldn't have done. I get constantly berated by my wife for this. Because I jumped in, I made the call and I said, look, here's what I am. And the reason I did it was because I looked at what I was receiving as disability living allowance. And I should say that this kind of came out of a conversation while I was helping my mother. She was getting some help from a welfare rights officer when she needed some assistance. And while I was there, the woman spotted I had a white cane and she could tell I was visually impaired. And she said, while you're here, do you want some advice on anything? She said, because I might be able to help you. And I said, well, the only thing I'm wondering about is personal independence payment. And we talked, and I told her what I was receiving per week, and she just was shocked, frankly. And she said, oh, hang on a minute. You're first of all, you're on the wrong level of disability living allowance. You should be on a higher level. That's all wrong. That needs to be addressed. But of course, by doing that, you will trigger personal independence payment. So, like you, David, I ended up in a situation where I kind of did it by myself. I triggered it, but it was triggered, and I got the form. And you know, I'm like you. I don't really understand what the problem will be here. And like you, the system is fine. You know, I get people have problems, but, you know, I'll be okay. And then I got a letter telling me that I hadn't attended an appointment. Now, I didn't get a letter, first of all, and I know I didn't get a letter because of two reasons. One, I'd been looking at letters every single day that had been coming in, and all letters I get from the DWP come in audio form for me, so they always come with a CD. I would know a letter had come, and it didn't. So I called them up, and I was told, well, you've missed your appointment, so that's that. And I then got a letter telling me that my disability living allowance was stopped, and well, good luck to you, unless you want to appeal it at tribunal. And I made the decision to do that. I then bizarrely, and I say this just on the very day that I got a letter telling me that I'm now getting an assessment in a week's time, although I'm apparently going to tribunal, I'm now getting an assessment, the assessment that I didn't get, or didn't get a letter about. So I'm in a very odd position here. I don't know what's going to happen. I've been told that the assessor's coming to the house. I think that must terrify people. because, you know, what does that mean? You start to think about everything, don't you? You know, you think, well, what are they going to think of my house? Are they going to think, oh, look at this guy, he's got a nice house, so, you know, clearly he's an independent guy. I mean, you know, and you kind of play all these daft scenarios out in your head, like, is it that big, really? Wow, I had no idea. But, you know, it's just one of those things that I feel that the experience so far for me has been exhausting. I've tried not to let it stress me out too much. I was fortunate enough that I was clearly on so little DLA that, you know, it hasn't made a huge dent in my life not to have it. But it's not, as you say, Alan, it's not about having money in your pocket. That's not what this is. This is access to, you know, getting a taxi instead of a bus, because I can't use buses. So I always use taxis. And where I live, there is only one bus, and it's on a road that's very inaccessible. You know, people will die trying to cross this road, and that's whether you're sighted or not. You know, I have to use other forms of transport. There's no local train, there's no, you know, so that's where these costs, additional costs come in. Cleaning the home, all these things are part of it.
And let's also look at the savings that can create as well, because if there wasn't, say, personal independence payments or DLA, disability living allowance, would you then, if you weren't perhaps as independent as many people are, would you then say, okay, social services, I need help each day in my house to keep it clean. Charities, yes, I need help to get out and go to an appointment. Can you get your volunteers to come along? Other people then pick up the slack. The councils are then having perhaps to fund help and support for you in the home, which probably in the long term is more expensive than giving you PIP in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And just the whole of, I mean, that sounds like a shambles, Stephen.
Did you not get the text? Usually you get two texts saying your form has not yet been received. And when I was filling out the forms, the people I spoke with at RNIB and Deafblind Scotland said, oh yeah, you'll probably get one or two texts saying they haven't received it. You might get a letter as well saying we haven't received your form, but you have. Don't worry, everybody gets these. And I thought, why? And how much does it cost to tell everybody by text and by letter that you haven't received the form when actually you have? And apparently this was very standard.
And those texts and letters say, if you've returned your form within the last 10 days, ignore this letter.
Yeah, and I was kind of worried about receiving it, because even though I'd been told, don't worry about it, I did, and I phoned them up and I said, has my form actually gone? Yes, it's gone. Don't worry about it. We told you it would happen, but you still have to check.
There was another thing as well with my, when, you know, I phoned them the day that I got my rejection letter, and within that rejection letter there are excerpts of the report that is written about you, and it was, as I said, it was rubbish. So I said, okay, I want you to look at it again. You get 28 days to send in any further information or anything else, any other statement, basically anything you want to say. So I said, before I do that, can you send me my full report, because I want to know exactly what's been said about me. And they said, yeah, of course we can. And I said, can you send it in my preferred format, which is large print, and not the format you'd sent my letter in, which was apparently large print, but large print where all the lines were squashed together, so it was just one lump of text on a page. And so they said, okay, yeah, we can do that. And they went scuttling off, and then they came back about 5 minutes later and said, apparently we can't do that, we have to send it to another department to get that done. So I said, all right, fine, do that. I said, how long will that take? We don't know. And they actually said, we have absolutely no idea, no one tells us anything. So I sat with it about 8 or 9 days later. I got a phone call from that department saying, what sort of format would you want? And I explained to them, okay, we can do that. It will take us 3 weeks to get it to you. And so my request to be looked at again had to be in on a day. The report, the full report about me, which I would assume kind of natural justice would say, you need to see that before you actually send us your information, arrived 3 days after that deadline.
And you wonder why we have concerns when changes are even muted about anything to do with the benefits agency or welfare payments.
I mean, the thing is, I mean, I got a call, I got a couple of calls, and one of them was about evidence. They required evidence of my sight problems. And I was asked the question, you know, do you have... I said, well, I've actually included in my application my registration of blindness, because I had a I know it's changed now, but of course at that time it was you were on the blind register or you were on the partially sighted register. And I was registered, I mean, I was born with this condition, but I was actually registered at 14. And I said, I've sent that in. And she said, oh yes, but we need evidence of your actual eye conditions. Are you in consultation with a doctor? Are you, you know, seen at a hospital? And I said, no. And she said, you're not seen at a hospital. And I said, no, because there's nothing they can do about it.
Yeah. Oh, look, come in. Yes, you're still blind.
And that was almost, she was almost getting to that sort of, so hasn't that sight problem just faded away now and it's all come back?
Is it not all
and
better?
It's all fine. Yeah. Hasn't it healed like a scar? No, oddly enough, it hasn't. So you go through all this and, you know, I can laugh about it because, you know, it is what it is. I can understand why people who'll be listening to this and listening to our conversation are sitting maybe terrified about this and also thinking, you know, when that letter comes through, if they say no, that's it, I'm giving up. Don't give up.
Absolutely. Alan got it right. It's an entitlement.
Something
that you deserve. It will help you. You know, you will get it.
And don't do it on your own. You know, contact RNIB's teams and get the help, the support and the advice because it is invaluable. And it's free.
This is, you know, just riled me that much that I really feel like, you know, there's some stuff that needs to be done. And questions are being asked in Parliament about the process for PIP for other conditions, particularly mental health, and good luck to them. You know, I hope they get what they need. But, you know, we can be doing stuff about this as well. I'm certainly not going to let this lie. I'm making a complaint to the DWP just about the way they handled it, the whole kind of front end, you know, end-to-end service, the terrible nature of the decision. But it's also, you know, there's an MP. They're our servants. We should all individually and collectively be standing up and saying, look over here, because there's a perception in the wider public, and I've picked this up from work recently with RNIB, but a perception in the wider public that people who are blind are looked after. You know, the government just looks after them, so there's no problems. You know, we know that's not true, but the rest of the world doesn't, and if we don't shout about it, they will never know.
Yeah, we get put in our blind buggy and it's all lovely and our world is all very, very, you know, nice, and we just do our thing and that's it.
You know, there's just generally a belief that the government, you know, if you're blind, yeah, the government will look after you. Of course they will. Why wouldn't they?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
And people just have a genuine belief that that's the case. But we know that's not. And we know that life is made very difficult by stuff like this. And I think, you know, rather than just getting angry and stomping around the house, certainly personally, I need to do something about it.
Yeah, for the greater good. I think the answer is actually to get Donald Trump on the case, because whenever Donald Trump says something against our country, it seems to unify everybody. I mean, look at the NHS thing recently. You know, he talked out against the NHS, and suddenly everyone thinks the NHS is the greatest thing since sliced bread, which, by the way, it is. But, you know, it's taken him to say it against it, and that's it. So if he was to say something like, oh, those blind people shouldn't be on personal independence payment, the government would change its policy on everything. So let's tweet at real Donald Trump and get it done. just get on Fox News. That's all we need to do. Get me on Fox News for 5 minutes. We'll get it sorted. Okay, I want to move on to our other topics because, you know, we could talk about this all day, and we should probably come back to this topic more than once, I think. And if you've got a view on it, then, you know, you've got to share it with us and tell us what your experience has been, whether it be like, you know, a good experience or a really bad experience. Tell us about it, because if we know about the experiences, at least then others are aware of it and can maybe, you know, we can help each other through conversation and hopefully some action as well. You can email us here, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. Now, your second topic, David, was all around barriers that we put up on ourselves, essentially, as blind or partially sighted people that can hold us back. Tell us your premise of this argument.
So, this is really, it's a subject that I've kind of always had go around in my mind, and I'll talk about to people individually when it kind of crops up or when it seems like it seems appropriate. But it's something that I sort of feel like never gets talked about kind of more publicly and with RNIB, with other organisations. I guess it starts from the point that you know, take it as a given. We all know that the world isn't built for people who can't see. We all know that there's a huge lack of understanding out there about what it is to live with little or no sight. And we all know that there are, you know, that life is difficult. But as we've just said, you know, we all find workarounds, we all find ways of doing it, and we all get on with our lives to a lesser or greater extent. But those barriers are kind of imposed. I believe from a lot of conversations over years and years with people with varying degrees of sight loss, though, that there's also kind of internal barriers, things we create ourselves. And I don't know what the cause of it is. Maybe it's fear. Maybe it's kind of in some cases, you've just spent so long being told you can't do things that you believe it or what it is. But I thought, well, where else can I talk about that than the Weekly Connect? And it really stemmed, the reason for doing it. It was a recent conversation I had with a guy who's quite young, who's looking for work, and he's registered blind. He has, you know, he's in his early 20s. He's has about as much vision as I think I did at his age, so he can see okay, but you know, not brilliantly, but okay. And I was talking to him about finding work, and he was saying, you know, he'd never worked, never had a job, but really wanted to. And so he was doing a lot, you know, a lot of great stuff to try and find a job. So he was doing lots of volunteering. He was turning up every time any of the charities that he was engaged with says, we really like someone to come and help us with this. He was always the first on the list. He was getting himself around and about. He was making every, you know, all of those efforts. And I said to him, but so what means you, you know, why haven't you got a job? And he said, well, I've applied for a few jobs with charities, and I haven't got anywhere. I've had some good advice about my applications, and you know, I hope I'll try again. I'll keep looking out for jobs with those charities. And I said, yeah, what is it you want to do? And he said, I really want to work in the sort of the blind and partially sighted sector. I want to work for a charity that works with blind people. So I said, okay, that's very laudable. You know, very, very good ambition. You know, I've done it for a long time, and it's rewarding, good job, and, you know, potentially, you know, good long-term prospects with it. But I said to him, why are you waiting? Why are you sitting around and waiting for another job to come up? Why aren't you just going to get a job? Because the basic premise for me is that a job is better than no job, and when you're in a job, you can find another job, and the more you do that, the more likely you are to get the job you want. And he sort of said, well, I don't think another employer would look after me. And sort of drilling down into it in the conversation, it came across, I got quite a strong sense that in his mind, there was this sort of bad world outside, and working for, say, RNIB or a local society or guide dogs or anyone like that will simply be, you know, that will be a safe place to work. Yeah, and that's fair enough. You know, I don't have a problem with that. And you know, those organisations should be the best places that you can work if you are blind, in terms of your experience of, you know, your daily working experience. But it worries me that people put themselves into this box and say, you know, the world outside isn't helpful. Whereas my experience and the experience of the people I know who are blind or partially sighted and work out in the world and are very successful, is that you have to put yourself out there and get on with it. And you know, there's a point in your life, I think, where whether you're talking about work or, you know, keeping going a hobby or going out and doing, you know, going out with your friends or, you know, taking up an activity or an opportunity, traveling, whatever it is, there's a point in your life where you have to say, yeah, I know I'm blind, but I've just got to get over it. Mm. And I just think it's a subject that rarely gets talked about in our sector. I think you know, people like us can probably talk about it quite comfortably, but those people who work in the organizations who are sighted, I think it presents an element of fear. There's a sort of an element of fear of saying something wrong. And I thought, well, where else can I talk about that but with Stephen and Alan?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because the three of us sitting here all work for a blind charity, yeah, so yeah. Probably not the best people to criticise this or his decision at all. I mean, what I would say is, and I think, Alan, you need to come back on this because, you know, yes, we do work for a blind organisation, RNIB, But we're not here because, well, I don't think, I'm certainly not here because it's an organisation that I kind of gravitated to because of my blindness. What about you?
I lost my sight when, about 2000. So I worked in, we should say, mainstream organisations and corporates and so on before I lost my sight. So I went through the whole, rehabilitation, for like learning to use assistive technology and canes and dogs and things. And volunteering was a way for me to build up those skills and relearn things as well. And I kind of, I suppose I ended up working in the charity world almost by mistake because I was volunteering. But there's probably two strands to that. One was because I felt that employers wouldn't understand sight loss. There wasn't really, there was a kind of access to work, if you like, system there to help support people with disabilities in employment. It wasn't as good as it is now. And I think I was kind of concerned that I go into this job, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it. Am I going to get support? Is it going to be, oh God, he's not very good at this, right? We'll just have to let him go and I've got to start the process again. And I thought, I'm in this blind charity. And it was a bit embarrassing at first. And people say, oh, where do you work? Oh, I work for a blind charity. Because that's what all blind people do, isn't it? when you're not getting your PIP or not getting it. And I started to realise that, unfortunately enough, in the position that I'm in, is that I'm not just doing a day-to-day job. I'm helping affect change. I'm helping inform people inside and outside the sight loss community, if you like. So that the job that I do is huge. It's very, very broad. I can make progress in what I do, and I love the job that I do. And I absolutely believe that we make a difference here at RNIB Connect Radio, as does RNIB as a charity as a whole. Some people could argue it's just a step up from the old sheltered workshops where you had a disability and you went into the little factory and you did your job and you got your pay and you went home and you never aspired to go beyond that. I suppose sometimes I do aspire to go maybe into a more mainstream environment again, but I then think to myself, well, do you know what, the job's not done. And I'm here to do a job, and it's going to take a long time to do it. I totally get that some people feel safe, and that barrier goes up that they don't want to push themselves into a mainstream environment job. That's the best way I can describe it, actually, not working out with the third sector, shall we say. Because I think there's still that fear, and I think justifiably so sometimes, that someone with a sight loss condition just isn't understood in the other sectors very well. I think it's getting better. There's more support there through things like access to work and organisations like RNIB working with other employers. But I think that still exists, that fear. And if you're not supported, you've got to go through the whole rigmarole of being out of a job again, trying to get in a job again. And maybe, looking at a third sector post is a bit of an easier way. It's a more comfortable place to be, a more safer environment.
That's interesting. I never knew that about you, Alan. This is what I love about this programme. I always learn something. But what's interesting is, I have, as I said earlier, had a sight problem since the day I was born. So it's not really a problem for me. It's just an everyday thing. But when I get into the workforce, I mean, it was a case with me. I was brought up with my mother and my grandmother, who are very strong Scottish women, who, the idea of not going to work was just not unheard of. It just wasn't going to happen. I had to work. So I did. And I went out and I did a couple of different jobs. My least favourite job of all was washing buses in a garage through the night.
I thought that would have been your ideal job, buses.
Well, I am known to be a bit of a bus anorak. Well, at least I was for a while. Kind of lost that interest now. But bus anorak in the sense of the vehicles, but not actually using them for any, purpose. But what was interesting to me was that, I went to the garage, as it was. I was just looking for a job. I was working in radio at the time. I had the job I was in radio had come to an end, and I knew that I had another job that I could go to, but it wasn't going to be for another couple of months. And I thought, well, I can't sit around and do nothing. And like you say, David, I'd rather be in a job than not. So, I thought, right, I'll go and do this. So I got a job washing buses. The joke was, I never told anyone. I could get away with not telling anybody I was visually impaired. And to be honest, washing buses, does it really matter? I mean, really? So you point a hose at a bus. You know, I mean, how hard is it? So, you know, not to decry the job, but, you know, it is what it is. So I went along, and the guy, he said to me, okay, your first, what I need you to do is the first bus I need you to do is over there. It's number 43 or whatever. And he threw me a set of keys, and he said, right, on you go. And I realised that, hang on, I said, what do you mean, drive? I said, oh, I can't drive. And I just sort of bluffed it by saying, well, I don't have that licence. And he said, it doesn't matter, you're on private property. Ah. And I said, look, I'm going to have to level with you here. I've actually got a slight problem. I can't drive. And he said, fine. And he just grabbed the hose and the thing and whatever it was, the equipment, and just said, well, just take it over to the bus then. And that was what I did. Instead of moving the buses around, I just took the stuff to the bus and washed it. So I was able to get the job done, and I did it for a few months. Hated it. It was freezing cold night work. But it was, you know, it gave me some money. And then I got back into radio, and I ended up at RNIB. And I say ended up as if it's the end of the world. I ended up at RNIB, which was a brilliant move for me, because they had, you know, launched this radio station, and I wanted to come and be part of it because I just loved the idea of, you know, two subjects I knew so much about: radio and visual impairment. And I thought, let's use this experience here. So I never really thought about the idea of coming to work for a blind charity. I think it was someone who said to me later on, that's a bit ironic, isn't it? You've got a visual impairment, you work for a blind charity. And I never really put them together that way. So it's just really interesting to hear our experiences of how we ended up working here, and, you know, our feelings on that.
And I should be kind of clear that really what I'm talking about here is just the sort of self-imposed limitations that I think at some point in our lives we all put on ourselves. And the phrase was used to me maybe a couple of years ago. I was on a leadership program, which I pushed myself onto, where I went and stayed at a business school for a week with sort of senior management from all walks of life. You know, I was the only charity person there. I was the only blind person who'd ever been to that business school, apparently. And part of the point of me going there was, you know, pushing myself into an uncomfortable environment. And as part of it, you had to set out part of your objectives. And I said, you know, I want to understand how much of this is limitation I put on myself, you know, first thinking maybe, you know, I couldn't go somewhere else, or I couldn't do what I do somewhere else, and how much of it is actually, you know, other people or kind of true. And by the end of it, the people there genuinely answered that question, and the phrase they used was, your visual impairment can be bigger to you than it is to everybody else. And I think that was a really good way of putting it, that I was certainly, you know, in some parts of my life pulling up barriers in front of myself. But there's, you know, employment's one bit, and I should be kind of really clear that, you know, I want more blind people to work at RNIB, not because I want to keep them safe and corral them all together, but actually because I think, you know, the lived experience of you know, the things we do every day, you know, 24/7, will just make the things that RNIB do better.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know,
it will be a better organisation.
In another world, I'd love to be the guy who was in charge of IT at RNIB, because I just love, you know, I mean, in my tech, I love all that stuff. So that would be a great job, but it's nothing to do with blindness. And that's the thing, you know, it's the RNIB is a great organisation to work for. That's why I work with it. And, you know, I'm really glad I got the job here, because it's been a great experience, and I'm sure that you guys would say the same. But you're right, we do put barriers up in front of ourselves, because if someone says to you, and we've all been there, and I've had my share of it, where people say, well, you can't do that. I mean, when I said at school I wanted to be in radio, they laughed. Mm. No. What you need to do is learn to type, because you'll be a secretary. And I was told that at school, and I remember thinking, really, is that it? And that can go two ways. Your guy you mentioned there, David, he might think, well, maybe that is it. Maybe that's the only option. But then I had a different approach, which was, sod you, I'm going to do this.
But society, then, you're saying society put that barrier up for you right at a very early stage. So it's almost that kind of medical model of disability rather than the social model of disability. And you are told at that young age, this is what you can do and this is what you can't do. So you probably carry that for quite some time. And it probably is a difficult barrier because, as David said, you know, that's just not an employment. That could be in everyday life, you know, going out and, you know, meeting a girl, going out socialising, and you think, well, oh, can I do that? But how do I go into a bar? I can't see them. Yeah. How do I do that? You know, yeah. So there's probably all sorts of things that, and those barriers that are there.
You're absolutely right, Alan. It's things, just very simple stuff like going shopping, you know, and how, you know, I'll get someone else to do that, because you know, and until you kind of push yourself over that threshold, you continually rely on others, and I just think you get less out of your life. And you actually, I think you find that when you push yourself out there, you find that the world is a much more welcoming place than you imagine.
It could also be, I suppose, maybe, I don't want to use the word laziness here, but you know, if you had, say, mail, a pile of mail, and there's technology there, scanners or, you know, apps on phones that can help us read our mail. But it takes a bit longer than reading it, you know, independently. So is it easier to just say, oh, do you know what, I'll just wait till the wife's home and I'll get her to read that letter, because I've got to get the phone out, I've got to launch the app, I've got to hold it over here, and I'll just get someone else to do that for me.
People in general are naturally kind of lazy. If there's an easier way to do it, 99% of people will take that easier route. And so I don't think it's wrong to say there's an element of, you know, I'll get someone else to do because it's easier and it saves me a job. There's this perception of what the world would be like if I kind of took a risk. If I'm not brave and I don't put myself out there, I won't find the world is as bad as I think it is, and I'll be all right, I'll keep myself kind of safe. And I just think we all need to kind of push ourselves out into the world and push the barriers down that are in our own minds and push the barriers down that are outside. I mean, another example is a guy I know elsewhere who is waiting to move out into a flat that he's been given. You know, he's got a place to live, but he's not going to move out because no one's shown him how to use a washing machine. And I just said to him, you know, just bloody try it, you know, have a go.
That's the problem though, isn't it? Because, you know, so that's a really good example of this, because you know sighted people will just not know what to say there. They'll just, they will be more likely to say, and this isn't a get it sighted people thing at all. I actually completely sympathise here, because there is that, what do you say? I mean, I suppose if it was someone in a wheelchair standing next to me and they said, well, look, I can't do this because, and you know, whatever it was they mentioned, I thought they probably could do. How would I say that to that person without patronising them? But yeah, I just, it's a really difficult one, but I think you're right. This is kind of where the show comes in. This is kind of what these conversations are about, because, you know, we're all visually impaired guys. We've maybe had the experience, or we've had a similar experience. I mean, like that, you know, well, if you don't know how to use the washing machine, learn it. Figure out a way.
There are instructions.
There is a way to do everything, and it might not be the same way that the other guy does it who's sighted, but there is a way to do it.
There's a workaround somewhere.
But don't cut a big avenue off in your life simply because no one's told you how to do it.
I'm not moving house because of it.
Yeah.
What?
Absolutely.
You know, I think we all accept there are things we can't do. You know, I always tell people that, you know, I know I'll never drive, and I know I'll never be a sniper, but, you know, everything else I'll have a go at.
Yeah.
You know?
I can drive. It's the steering that's the problem.
we just want to say, though, in a kind of health and safety thing, if you are blind or partially sighted and you get a job washing buses in a garage and they throw the keys at you, don't say, I can do this, and try and drive the bus.
Don't get me wrong. I was very tempted. Now, listen, we are running short of time. This hour of therapy that we do every week here on the show, it drifts by so quickly. I want to talk about technology. This is a major interest of mine, as you know, David. And I think that it'd be a shame not to bring this up on this programme, because you've got yourself some of those Amazon devices. Now, I will say to those listening, if you've got one of those Amazon devices, you might want to stick a sheet over it or something while we talk, because we may bring up that name that wakes her up. But you're loving these Amazon Echoes, aren't you?
Well, yeah, and I started my Amazon Echo journey, I guess, because at Christmas I got myself, I was bought a very nice speaker that has Alexa. Sorry, I just said it.
That's where it all started.
Apologies, anybody. and it was built in, and we set it up Christmas morning and had a go. You know, called out her name and said, "Play this song." And out it came. I thought, this is pretty good. And so just started asking a few questions, and who is this person? What is that? And getting the response. And then within 5 minutes, my kids, who are 5 and 7, were there. They were also asking her questions and asking her to play music. And suddenly she almost became like part of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Where we were getting, you know, by the next day, if instead of kind of the answer being go and ask mummy or go and ask daddy, it was go and ask Alexa.
Very good.
And so, you know, it's, you know, as a few days went on and I found out that there was a guardian skill and a telegraph skill and there was a football news skill and there was travel skills, I just started playing with it. And now I can, you know, as close as I've been able to for years and years, I can read the opinion pieces in the paper that I want to read without kind of without having to get someone else involved or go to another library. I can just walk into the room and say I want to read the paper, and I'm going to, and I'm doing it for 5 minutes and I'm gone again, exactly as I would have done had I been able to see. And I could walk in, pick up the paper, read a piece and walk out again. And it just feels like suddenly there's been this huge kind of explosion in my life that is, you know, technology and digital. My iPhone was a huge leap in my life. I've suddenly been able to do things for myself with the various apps, the travel apps and all the guiding stuff. And you know, seeing AI now is just tremendous. But you always needed to have a special bit with it. You always needed to switch on the Zoom or the voiceover. So you had to do something that other people didn't. Now there's been this explosion where everybody in the world is using their voice. And I can do that. And I'm just one of the many people doing it. So it got really exciting. The speaker I got, I mean, you know, the she whose name must not be said.
Well, go and say it and then say play R&IB Connect Radio.
Yeah. she's kind of in the speaker that I've got she's on their platforms. So some of the things that she can do weren't activated, so I can't work on that speaker. So last week I bought myself the Echo Dot to go in the kitchen. So now when I'm in the kitchen or in the dining room, I've got my audiobook and I don't have to kind of hook my phone up to a Bluetooth speaker and find the place and do that. I can get that book, I can get the podcast, I can get my radio, I can get all the stuff. And I now know that I can do drop-in on my sister who lives 100 miles away but has an Alexa in her kitchen. Just sneak that one in.
Isn't that incredible?
I can just say, drop in on, you know, on my sister, and I'm talking to her whilst I'm out and around and about. And I think more than things like FaceTime and the video conferencing and calling, I think we as creatures are more naturally attuned to just being able to talk to a voice.
Absolutely.
You know, rather than having to look at something. But overall, it's just the sense that this isn't special for me, and that's the first time in year, you know, 25 years that I've had that sense where, you know, I can talk about exactly the same bit of kit to my friends down the pub because they've got it and they're doing the same things as I am.
It's off the shelf, isn't it? It's not, like you say, it's not specialist. Everyone says, oh, Amazon Echo, go, oh yeah, I've got one of them. And like you know, I was like a kid at Christmas opening it up. It was, you know, it's like, oh, I can't wait to get this going. I bought the Echo and I've got the bits and pieces here and we're going to hook it all up. And I just thought, right, let's look at these skills. And there was pages of the things. Open that. And it did so much, like you say, Dave, you know, playing music, news, weather, you know, what's around about you, ordering things to get delivered to the house.
Takeaways.
And, oh, yes.
Yeah, you get takeaways on it. I love that.
I haven't enabled that one because that would just be too dangerous.
It's dangerous. But you know what I love, David? You mentioned the dropping in. I looked at my contacts. I thought, who do I know's got an Echo? I'm going to call everyone. And I just sat there and went, call Stephen Scott. Call that. Call them. Call that. And people are going, hello? What?
I've got about six of these things in the house. And Alan called me and the entire house spoke, Alan Russell is calling you. And I think even the neighbours knew you were calling. So they can just shout through the window and say, hang up. But it is an incredible device. And what I love about it is the fact that you're right. You know, this is a device that if you have problems with it or you think, how do I do this? You can turn to anybody on earth and say,
how do you do that?
How do I do it? Because there's hang on, there's a special blind command you need. No, there isn't. You just use your voice. It works. Brilliant.
And it's just that it feels like it's the start of something really big and a huge change.
Yeah, my wife thinks there's another woman in my life. That's what I talk to her apparently more than talk to the speaker more than to my wife.
I've seen videos of things like, you know, office photocopies that are enabled by Alexa. So people don't even have to press the buttons anymore. They just tell the machine what they want. And it's that kind of development of technology that is just going to be a huge enabler for people who are blind and partially sighted. That's so exciting.
Well, you know, I suppose I should use this as a plug. wouldn't be.
Oh, plug.
It would be. Yes, I know. No, I just this week, actually, when this show goes out, on the same week, on the Tuesday at 1 p.m. slot on R&B Connect Radio, and of course on the podcast, you'll get Tech Talk as well. This week, we're actually talking not so much about the Amazon Echo devices, but the technology that we can add in our home that connects through those Amazon Echo devices. Alan is looking for a slow cooker, and I've got a solution for him, for example. So, you know, yes, it is an Amazon Echo enabled slow cooker. So, you know, this kind of smart tech is starting to take over, which is absolutely brilliant. And, you know, we'll be talking more about it on the show. David, thank you so much for being on the show this week. So many topics of interest there, and I'm sure that will stimulate a lot of discussion among the community who listen to this program regularly. I hope you've enjoyed being here.
It's absolute pleasure.
Excellent. Well, if people want to get in touch, of course, the usual way is by email, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. Alan, it's been great having you on the show as well this week. Thank you so much for coming in.
We must do this again. I'll stay up late again and do it. It's been great.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he gets up very early in the morning, David, to do the breakfast show, as you know. I mean, the show starts at 7. You get up at what, 5 to 7?
Oh, well, I'm in here just before 6 a.m.
Yeah.
As long as you roll your sleeping bag up under your desk, then I don't mind.
I'm moving in upstairs shortly.
Alan, of course, you are back on the morning show, 7 till 10 on the early show. I remember it well. I hope you're treating her well. I used to spend a lot of time in that studio doing that show, but... yeah, you're on air 7 till 10 weekdays. And David, thank you once again. That is it for the Weekly Connect for this week. You can join us, of course, at any time online at rnibconnectradio.org.uk. You can find us on Freeview Channel 730. And, of course, we're also available as podcasts. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, if you need a good excuse to try and get yourself back to sleep, you can find our podcast. I'm only kidding. You can find some great entertainment. And we have lots of it on there. Find it on iTunes, Audioboom, or wherever you get podcasts. That is the Weekly Connect for this week. Thank you so much for being here. Remember, if it is Monday at 1 p.m., it's the Weekly Connect. Goodbye.